You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Fleetwood Mac follows Nielsen. Stevie Nicks. She thought she was a witch at some point. Whatever. They call them drugs for a reason. But Fleetwood Mac, they could produce some music. So I'm watching a Senate Armed Service Committee testimony yesterday. And honestly, it's astounding to watch. And I'm tapping into the surface community to get guests. So, yeah, the blog's called Commander Salamander. They do a podcast, too. And they're surface guys. Thunder only happens when it's raining, which isn't actually true. Players only love you when they're playing. That is true. When the rain won't what? You clean? I don't even know what she's singing for. And I've been singing it for years. Yeah. I'm that person. What? Alright, enough of Stevie Nicks. Okay, Senate Armed Service Committee yesterday. So the testimony looks like this. Alright, the questioning you're going to hear, I was going to play you John McCain's opening statement, but I'm not going to do that in the interest of time and staying on schedule, which I rarely do, but because I'm going to be disciplined today. What you're going to hear is 2 hours into it, Senator Angus King, who is a Democratic senator from the state of Maine, where they have fishermen up there, okay? He gets his chance to ask questions, okay? Now, this is about 90 minutes into the whole thing. So, here you have it. And then, so the next 40 minutes is testimony. And it gets probably more pointed than the previous 90 minutes was.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. While in no way denigrating all the discussion that we've had today about staffing and training and adequacy and hours of work, I think all those are contributors, but I'm surprised. I want to turn to an entirely different subject. Every boat in the Gulf of Maine has a radar on it that tells us when there's another boat within a mile or 2 miles or 5 miles, an alarm goes off, it shows up on your GPS. How in the world does a $1 billion destroyer not know that there's a freighter closing in on it? I don't understand how this could possibly happen. And I've talked to Maine lobstermen. They're scratching their heads. They can tell when there's a flock of seagulls off their bow.
Sir, got the same questions. It's very hard to understand with the sophisticated systems on board these warships that we let a ship get in that close to the point of collision. And so that is a direct
not a focus. Ship, three ships. Three of these were collision with right. Merchant vessels.
Yes, sir.
I mean, aren't there, can you give me an answer specifically? Aren't there radar systems
there are,
on
yes,
these
there.
Ships
there's,
that
there's
would
a
detect
primary,
anything within the range?
There's a primary and a backup radar that should detect those ships. There are systems that can alert you at a particular range, and so we have to find out what happened.
Is there a black box on these ships like there is on an aircraft so we can determine what the sequence of events was?
We'll get to the sequence of events, yes, sir.
And the second question is, don't we have sailors on the bridge with binoculars anymore?
We do. Required to have lookouts, and we have lookouts on the watch team on the bridge.
Is there? And the other question is about the radar of these ships that ran into us. Is there some technology that they couldn't see us? Are these? Are we using a stealth technology? Anything you can answer in an open setting?
Sure. I mean, it wouldn't surprise anybody, I think, that we design our warships to have a lower radar cross-section. I mean, it's some designed to be very low, right? So that degree of stealth makes us more effective from a warfighting standpoint. But that also imposes a burden, if you will, on the crew of that ship to understand that they are low observable and that they may not be as easily seen as something that is as large as a destroyer. It'll have a radar cross-section of a ship that's much smaller.
Or if they're not in a conflict situation, to emit some kind of signal to another.
That's been an immediate action, is that there is this automatic identification system, AIS, that the Secretary mentioned, and we had, I think, a distorted perception of operational security that we kept that system secure off in our on our warships. One of the immediate actions following these incidents is that, particularly in heavily trafficked areas,
like,
we're just going
like,
to turn it on.
Like you Japan.
Can, right, you can look outside and see the ship, and so it's not an operational security standard.
So you can't report to us today any results of investigation into what happened with the non-performance of the radar system?
Those specifics are forthcoming.
Forthcoming soon?
As soon as the investigations are complete, yes, sir.
All right, let me turn from this subject for a moment to maintenance. I think the testimony from our friend from the GAO was that the maintenance capacity is not adequate and that, therefore, we have ships that are in port too long, and that puts a strain on the ships that are left at sea. Is that accurate?
I think Mr. Pendleton painted that exact picture. The words he used were vicious cycle, and I would agree that's a good characteristic of that.
Because these ships are expensive, as you know, and anytime you have a capital object that's expensive, Secretary Spencer, you know from your business experience, you want it operating. Do we need to be talking about increasing the capacity of the maintenance yards to cut down on that time off the ocean, if you will?
I'll go first. I think that there's no doubt that we could use increased maintenance capacity. Right now we are leveraging every ounce of capacity, I think, across the nation, both public and private, to execute the maintenance that we need.
But if we're executing on every ounce of capacity and it's not adequate, sounds to me like we need more capacity.
We need more, yes, sir.
And is that in the plans anywhere? Is that in any submissions of budgetary priorities in the future?
Well, one of the other reports that Mr. Pendleton just recently issued was a report on our shipyards, and so how to increase the capacity through modernizing our shipyards. We work closely with the private sector to have these discussions all the time in terms of how do we increase that capacity. So it's something that has our attention, yes, sir.
One final question on the technology. I would urge that a standard practice ought to be for these locational radar that keep an eye on what's in the vicinity, that if there should be an alarm, which I'm sure there is, and B, it should ring in the captain's quarters if anything comes within whatever the set distance is. It's really unacceptable in this day and age with the technology that we have to have something like this happen, regardless of the wider issues.
Now,
this is just unacceptable from a modern seamanship point of view, it seems to me.
Sir, I agree with you 100%, and that's why I'm fighting the tendency to characterize this. I mean, certainly there are tearing down forces that are broader. We've discussed many of those today, but this will go to, you know, proper operation of your equipment, fundamentals of watch standing. Those are the things that we have to look at.
Thank you.
That is the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral John Richardson. And to me, one of the things that bodes well for the Navy is his last answer, and that is, look, we can talk about all this other shit that we want to, but the bottom line is operating the equipment and standing watch. And that's why everybody who you hear who's part of the service Navy looks at this and says, there's no excuse for it. There's no excuse for it. None. But the, you know, another question is, why only the 7th Fleet? Is it just ragged? lack of attention to detail, lack of accountability, get away with shit. Nobody holds people accountable in the 7th Fleet. Why, if it was a Navy-wide problem, why don't we hear about it in the Med? Riddle me that, Batman. All right, they continue. And again, just to interject, this whole discussion of working 100 hours a week, you know, when you're deployed, what the fuck else do you do but work? You know, I was in Iraq in 2006, and in Afghanistan 2010-2011. A normal day is get up at 5, go get something to eat, right, and then go into work. So normally into work at 6 in the morning. Okay. And you're kind of just reading your email and getting your head out of your ass and reading reports from last night, SIG events, you know, different reports come in, the intel summary for the day that the Fusion Center puts out, the op summaries that are submitted. There's a thing that gets written every evening called the intentions report, and that gets written by the division. There's roll-ups in there for every regiment and significance of events, and then commander's comments from those. And you want to know those because when a commander, when a commander puts something on the record in his comments, that's a big deal. And so that's all part of just getting ready to go to work, right? Those are the things you need to know. So you're up at 5, you're into work by 6, after you shower and shave, go grab something to eat, walk over to work, right? But you're deployed. There's nothing else to do. If you're on a ship, what else are you doing except working? So I'm not going to get sanctimonious. I'm just going to tell you. So you get into work at 6, you normally have staff meetings, section meetings, you know, that take you probably till about 9 o'clock, and then you get after whatever you're working on. Okay. And then you'll still be there at say 2100 at night finishing things up. All right. So now let's just say that 06 to 6 to noon, that's 6 hours. Right. Well, wait, 21 minus 6 is 15. So that's 15 hours a day. What is 15 times 7? Now, and mind you, if there's shit going on, you'll be there later. So I would just tell you, these are pretty standard, from my experience, pretty standard shit. And you do that 7 days a week, that's 105 hours with no overtime. And that's just what else are you gonna do? Are you gonna leave it like 8 hours, and then what are you gonna do for the next? What are you gonna do for the next 14, 16 hours of the day? Fucking go play video games and walk around the shit? No, you work, man. It's what you do when you're there. Now the question is, are leaders doing what they need to do? Because let me tell you, when you see somebody, and we had them, and I mean officers, staff NCOs, and then junior Marines, they can't stay awake at a meeting. And somebody has to yoke their ass up and say, hey, go back to your hooch and go to sleep. And then once they come back, while they're gone, you grab one of your staff NCOs, a junior officer, and say, hey, find out what they're doing, what's going on, why can't they stay awake? And it may be something, a personal issue in their life where they're having problems at home and they get off work and they go get on a phone and they can't sleep. And so it's impacting them at work. But what I just described to you, that's normal. That's just normal work. And then in the course of those hours, those 15 hours, you'll eat. You know, if you didn't PT before you came to work, most guys will cut out for an hour and go to the gym. Because that's good for your brain. So this whole notion of 100 hours a week when you work 7 days a week is somehow you're overburdened. I don't buy it. I want to know from them how many people are working like that. Because I would tell you the people that I knew, everybody worked like it. Ask Montana man Mike. You know, and then so Mike is, you know, when they're out operating, you know, what time do the Marines get up? Right? You're up with them, you're eating breakfast, and then you're either rehearsing, you're going to an order, you're going to a brief, and then you're out and about, right? And you're doing, and then you're gone all fucking day. You come back, you eat, you might go to an AAR, you find out what else happened. I mean, now you're talking about 2,100. That's your work day. Then you go to sleep, and then you get up and do it again. So, all right, so the hearing continues.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
On behalf of the chairman, let me recognize Senator Donnelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I want to join my colleagues in expressing my deepest condolences to the family and friends of the sailors we have lost in these incidents. We are grateful for the service, saddened by the loss. Extraordinary people. And Mr. Chairman, thank you for convening this hearing. Both our military leadership and Congress have roles to play to ensure this doesn't happen again. Admiral, I just want to follow up on my colleague Senator King's questions. And you mentioned that we'll get to the sequence of events and find out what happened. Do you have a time frame for that? Because we saw a number of incidents, and the goal is the faster we want to do it right, but the faster we get the facts as to what happened, the better the opportunity is to not have it happen again.
Right, Senator. We're taking sort of a two response along two time scales, if you will, sir. So we want to get the full investigation done with alacrity, and we are doing that. And so this fall, you know, a time frame, we'll get those complete. But we're not waiting for those things to be done to act. And so there are a number of tactical immediate actions. I mentioned the automatic identification system. We're going to turn that on so that we're much more visible to other ships, mandating that we perform both manual and electric.
Think about that. For the first time in the Navy's history, they will turn their transponders on because they can't keep from crashing in to other vessels at sea. What the fuck?
Electronic tracking of all other vessels that will come within 2.5 miles. We've got a mandated commanding officer review and approval of the watch bills, the watch teams that will be doing that. So there's a number of actions, my point being, that we are doing now to enhance the things that Senator King and you were talking about.
How many radar systems do you have on at a time? And are there backups for every?
For navigation and safety, two radar systems, a primary and a backup. And then there may be a third commercial radar that we use sometimes.
Were they working at the time of these incidents on both ships?
Sir, I don't have those details, so we'll get to that.
Mr. Pendleton, in your statement, you identify a number of recommendations from past GAO reviews that the Navy has not yet implemented. Which do you consider the most urgent of those?
I think with respect to the forward deployed naval forces, I think carving out dedicated training time for them is going to be very important. So that's probably my number one. When you look broader than that and begin to give a urgent, not necessarily since it needs to be done today, but the Navy needs to determine how many people it really needs and put on the ships, because 100-hour work weeks are not sustainable. So those would be the two I identify for you. Longer term, I think the shipyards are going to be a real issue. We just issued the report that was mentioned. There needs to be a capital investment plan on the shipyards. We're going to run out of dry dock space, and it's going to be hard to get out of this vicious cycle, sir.
Secretary Spencer, what do you look at as the most urgent things to implement right now?
I concur with training, but when I put on my Title 10 hat, we have to gear up on infrastructure. If we look at the maintenance cycles that we have here, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Pendleton, our bill is $4.2 billion.
I think it's actually $4.86
billion to get our yards back in shape. We're going to have to do something to move that ball down the road.
Thank you. Admiral, as has been mentioned, 100-hour work weeks are unsustainable. I know you have personal experience from your deployments that you've had. What are we doing?
Hey, would somebody send that memo to the Marine Corps? Hey, remember everybody when you deploy. Work at 100 hours a week. Not sustainable, okay? Fuck, who knew that? When did they make this rule up? Holy shit!
Right now, to change that paradigm of 100-hour work weeks and helping those individuals who are shouldering that burden right now, who are out in the field doing the very, very best they can to keep our nation safe.
So now the surface force, the submarine force, and the aviators all have mandatory sleep requirements now in place. The surface force just recently made that mandatory. It was recommended before. So
why aren't they sleeping? And it ain't because they're working. I guarantee fucking to you that. And so this thing continues. It's the sad truth when this whole thing gets aired out is you're going to see lack of discipline. But you know what? If I work 15 hours a day and then I want to go get on the internet and then I want to go play video games with my friends and fuck off, that's how this shit happens. Who's supervising that shit? And think about it. In the 7th Fleet, you had a cruiser hit a fishing ship, right? And the visibility was degraded at noon, okay, with three different radars on, and they still hit it. To me, if in the 1st Marine Division, we would have hit a fucking ship, and then we would have hit a second one, I shudder to think what would have happened. It would not have been business as usual. It would not have been business as usual after the first one. After the second one, where we lost life, after the first one, the paint would have come off the walls. Navy's not like that, though. And obviously the 7th Fleet not like that. And so now sleep is mandatory. Who's going to enforce that in the Navy?
Well, that will mandate that at sea in those watch rotations that we get sufficient sleep and get out of this cycle. The other thing is there is a cultural factor here where, you know, you've got, it's just a little bit more, you're more dedicated, if you will, if you can go the extra mile and stay awake. That's like pulling an all-nighter in college. I have two daughters in college, and you know, it's too common there as well. And so it's a combination of education and culture change to make sure that people are seeking this rest.
And the last thing I want to ask is, as you do these investigations, very often, as I know you're aware of, the people who know the best as to how to fix it are the ones who are in the front line and who are right there on the ships or in the submarines. And I want to know what we're doing to make sure we incorporate their ideas in how we move forward.
Yes, sir. It started with the operational pause. In my message for that, I mandated that those be small groups, you know, of sailors on the deck plate. Focus groups, I think, is the most effective way that I've seen to get after those types of concerns. That beats a poll or a survey or anything like that. And so that'll be a fundamental part of our way going forward.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you very much. On behalf of Chairman McCain, Senator Sullivan, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And gentlemen, thank you for being here and your testimony. I also want to offer my condolences to the families. And, this is just completely unacceptable, period. No debate about that. I don't think anyone's debating that. But it's, you know, when the men and women of our military do what less than 1% of Americans do in this country, which is raise your right hand to support and defend the Constitution and keep us safe. We got to do a better job, all of us, the Navy, the Marines, the Army, the Congress, and it's unacceptable. So, Admiral, I want you to, I'm having a hard time with this issue of kind of put us on the bridge of a modern Navy ship and talk about the redundancies, the radar, the GPSs, the physical watch. I know you're investigating this, but what does that look like? Aren't we
the most advanced Navy in the history of the world, and how are these kind of redundancies in terms of basic seamanship and collisions at sea breaking down in your view? And it's not just one, you know, sailor on the watch. There's a whole host of other things that would make sure we avoid these kind of collisions. What in your experience, first, what does that look like? And then what in your experience do you think is going wrong? Where obviously there's a series of failures here in these right. collisions, not just one. What does that look like, and how can we better understand it?
Right. Sir, my experience is just as yours, that these catastrophes really result from the accumulation of a number of small errors that build up and line up eventually to create a sequence that results in an incident of this magnitude. To put you on the bridge of a modern destroyer, a watch team will be on the order of 10 people. About four of those will be officers, the officer of the deck, the junior officer of the deck, officer of the watch, conning officer. There'll be two lookouts. There'll be a quartermaster. And so there's plenty of people involved in this seamanship and navigation on the bridge. They're supported by a team in the Combat Information Center, which is also looking at electronic displays. They don't have windows, but they're backing them up. With respect to the technology, the equipment for all of those critical systems, navigation, steering, propulsion, we have a primary and a backup system for every one of those. So GPS is backed up by inertial navigators. We have a primary and a backup radar for the rudders. We have two rudders, and each of those rudders has a primary and a backup hydraulic cylinder. And so there's a lot of redundancy built into these systems because they are so fundamental to safety. And so now you get a sense, and it goes back to Senator Donnelly's question and Senator King's point, which is how could all of that break down so catastrophically to result in a collision of this magnitude? And that's why we have to do the thorough investigation.
Let me ask another question. You know, it comes to readiness, it comes to training. One of the things in my relatively short time here in the Senate that I've been concerned about with regard to military readiness is that this committee, this Congress, well-intentioned, puts additional training requirements, additional things that you need to address. Because we told you. And to be honest, most of those don't relate to combat readiness. Most of them don't relate to basic MOS, whether it's a surface warfare officer or a Marine infantry officer and his, you know, duty to close with and destroy the enemy of our nation. How much of your training do you believe is being mandated by the Congress that takes you away from your basic MOS training? And if there are issues with that, we would certainly like to know about it. Mr. Secretary, can you try to address
that? Senator, let me address that for you.
You think it's a problem?
It definitely is a problem. Not only will you hear from my report group as to any actions done at the Senate level or need to be adjusted here in this chamber or other chambers, you're going to hear from them. We're going to address DOPMA. We're going to address the Inouye Amendment. We're going to address how Joint Chiefs task. We have given this committee an infinite reign, literally, to address everything. At the operational level, the Secretariat, the OPNAV, the CMC are all going through their instructions going, what are we focused on? We're focused on readiness and lethality. What do all our instructions support? And if we find instructions that are not focusing us on those two items, we're going to bring them to your attention if you have control of them. If we have control of them, we're going to try to adjust this. It's as I said earlier, the rucksack issue. All the best intentioned in the world, put a rock in to do a training on smoking cessation. Put a rock in to do other sorts of training. No one's taking a rock out, and the rucksack's getting pretty damn heavy.
Well, I couldn't agree more, and Admiral, I'm assuming you would agree with that, but I implore you to bring those issues back to us because there's only so many hours in a day. And the mission of the Navy, you know what that mission is, and we need to make sure our sailors are trained in the best way possible. And this rucksack issue you're talking about as a reservist myself, in the reserves it's even worse. Because there's less time in the year to train. So please bring those back. And again, my condolences to the families here. We need to fix this. And I know you're committed to doing it. It's going to be an all-hands-on-deck effort, but we cannot afford to lose any more of our nation's finest in training accidents. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. On behalf of the chairman, Senator Blumenthal, please.
Thank you, Senator Reid. Thank you all for being here today on a very difficult subject, especially for any of us from Connecticut. We lost two brave, courageous men, one on the Fitzgerald, the other on the McCain. I'd like to pay tribute to electronics technician second class Dustin Doyen and sonar technician third class Nak Chun Nguyen, both from Connecticut. Their families mourn them, and all of us in Connecticut are struck by the sadness and grief of their passing and their courage in joining in devoting their lives to the defense of our nation. And so we really owe them an investigation that's not only thorough and comprehensive, but also as prompt as possible. I am struck by a number of the questions and answers that have been elicited so far in dealing with this intensely human tragedy in such an abstract way, which maybe makes it easier to address. But I think most Americans find these crashes incomprehensible. So let me begin by asking you, Admiral, is there any indication so far that there was equipment failure on either the Fitzgerald or the McCain?
So we're taking a look at all of that, and that'll be part of the investigative results when we come out. It's premature to say conclusively whether that contributed, but it's not only the operating status of the equipment, but how it was operated. Was it being operated properly in accordance with the procedures? You know, all of these things will be a part of the result of that investigative look. Sir, I do also have to comment on how absolutely human this is to us. Every one of those sailors is like a son to me. And the opportunity to be with their families when they see them come back in these coffins, it makes it intensely human. And so we're going to get after this.
By the way, I did not mean to imply that anybody on this panel, and particularly you, Admiral, who has devoted your life to the Navy and service and sacrifice, would feel anything but the most intense pain and grief as a result. And having a son who has served in the Navy, another in the Marine Corps, I know that as a dad, I felt proud of the fact not only that they were serving, but that they were surrounded by people who really cared for them, and they were the best trained and the most dedicated of any military force in the history of the world. And yet, human error, as you've just pointed out, even with the best equipment, may result in failure to operate the equipment properly, which comes back to training. I have been told that since 2006, the Navy doubled the number of ships homeported overseas to 20, obviously to increase its forward presence and reduce crisis response time, but training was eliminated on these forward deployed platforms. As a result, the number of expired certifications increased fivefold from 7% to 37% between 2015 and 2017. Are those numbers accurate? I don't know whether they've been raised here before.
Yeah, most of that's coming from our work. The increase in overseas-based ships, I think, went from 20 to 40, which was about 7% of the Navy to 14% of the Navy. The certification numbers that you described, that is from 2015 January until mid this year. If you imagine the 11 ships that are based in Japan, we looked at all the certification areas, 22 of them. When we looked at that in 2015, and you imagine a bunch of little squares, 7% of those were red. When we came back in preparation for this hearing, 37% of them were expired, some of them 2 years or more. And so that was a trend that we alerted the Navy to and that we put in our updated work. For the most part, you have it right, but just wanted to make sure the specifics were. With respect to training, what we said is they didn't have dedicated training time, unlike the ships based in the United States. So before a ship deploys from the United States, it has a train-up period. The folks overseas were pretty much just almost always deployed. Is that fair?
In terms of what those numbers mean, 37% of those certifications were expired?
Yeah.
And that means that...
There's a periodicity to this. Every couple of years or less, you have to be certified that you can do things, drive the ship, work your comms, everything, and then warfare areas as well. So that means that they had missed that certification time.
And it doesn't necessarily mean that they were not competent to perform duties that they were doing, but it does reflect on the kind of training that was.
And the trend was of concern, as I think the admirals mentioned as well.
And I would just articulate that if that certification has meaning, then we got to do the damn certification. And we can't just walk by it and try and talk our way out that, hey, we're still proficient even though the cert's expired. That's just not an acceptable way to do business.
Well, not acceptable, I agree. 37% and going from 7% to 37% in just 2 years is pretty
egregious.
Staggering. Thank you.
Senator Sullivan wants to have another.
Just two quick ones, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much. It was really a follow-up to Senator Blumenthal's question, which was the home port versus the overseas ported versus kind of CONUS home ported ship. The statistics that were just read, I think, are pretty striking. And Admiral and Ms. Secretary, I know you're going to be looking at the specifics of these accidents and what specifically happened, but I think if you could also help address kind of the strategic elements, is there something that we should be looking at that makes the overseas ported ships that are based overseas going through different training, different deployment cycles? If you can help address that issue too, because it does seem like that's something that might be an element of this challenge. Do you agree with that?
Yes, Senator. Two things that have readily come out of this, as far as I'm concerned, and Mr. Pendleton hit on metrics. I'm a true believer in metrics. We have to know what we're measuring and what we're looking at. And this is a prime example of, can we get ourselves a dashboard that is very easy for, quote-unquote, management to look at the dashboard and have the appropriate indicators on there at any one time. This is what we need to do. We don't need to actually be having our hands and fingers into what's going on there. We have to have the first indicators on when to react and say, uh-oh, trending in the wrong position, let's address. If you look at the study that I have asked to be stood up, we are addressing the overall root causes of what's going on. The CNO is looking at tactical causes. We are going to be looking at root causes. We've asked people from BP North America to join us. They lived through the Deepwater Horizon tragedy and came out the other side with a very strong plan. We called the Maritime Academy and said, who is your poster child for maritime safety who's had an issue? And they said, speak to Crowley Marine. They had a bit of a rash. They have a great program now called Road to Zero. Called Tom.
All right, stand by because John McCain gets irritated here.
Tom Crowley, he said, you're on it. We looked at other situations that were out there. We called the Mayo Clinic. The Mayo Clinic has done 7 years of studies looking at high-pressure, team-oriented places, and what they were looking at were operating rooms where you had professionals, seven different teams of professionals doing a lung transplant over a 7-hour period, and they degraded the whole thing, started over again, and said, how do we build for optimum outcome. And it came to such human behavior aspects as the anesthesiologist can go, need a minute here, everyone stop, I need to stabilize something, and had input and control into a situation of pressure and intensity that had one leader. But they had to actually culturally realign how they communicate with everyone. These are the kind of insights and people we're going to have working on our level to really see if we will have a plan to do corrective action.
Great. Thank you.
Sir, if I could pile on, there is a real benefit to having ships forward deployed.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Don't get me wrong. I think it's actually critical that we have ships forward deployed.
And so for a number of reasons that you're aware of, what we do need to do when we forward deploy ships, though, to Mr. Pendleton's point, is we need to have a comprehensive understanding of what it takes to sustain that forward deployed force from a maintenance, training, infrastructure standpoint, people, you know, the whole thing.
Yes, and that's just what I'm requesting. Take a look at that issue as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let me just add, Admiral, I appreciate everything you're saying, but it doesn't take a study or RAND or Mayo when you're making people work 100 hours a week, okay? It doesn't take any study. I don't have to ask RAND to look at it. I think I know what 100 hours a week does to people over time. And that's been standard procedure for a long time. Why not declare a halt to it right now? Right now. They should not be working 100 hours a week. So I appreciate all our plans and all our remedies, but there's some of them that are just common sense that don't require a study. So I think the men and women who are serving in the Navy would like to see some immediate action taken. 7-month deployments are a long time. Up till now, there have been times where those deployments have been a lot longer than that. Who is looking out for them? Who's asking them to stay in? So I appreciate all the studies you've ordered and all the assessments and all that. There's some that all you have to do is use common sense and make some changes that would obviously relieve some of the strain. When somebody's working 100 hours a week, over a period of time, they're going to make mistakes. Any manager can tell you that. So, Mr. Secretary, I'm glad you have all these plans. I'm glad you're going to make changes. I'm glad you've got RAND and whoever the hell else it is that's studying it. There are some aspects of what we're subjecting the men and women who are serving, especially in the overseas deployment ports, that you could change. You could make the change tomorrow. And what we would like to see is some significant changes. Fire a few people, that's fine. But I'm not sure it relieves that individual who is still working 100 hours a week. And one of the reasons why that person is working 100 hours a week, obviously, is because the enormous burden that have been placed on them, not only to do their job, but also a lot of additional requirements that every time there's been a problem, well, let's give another lecture. Let's have another training session. Let's have another test. So, again, I appreciate what you're saying. I appreciate what you're doing. But I'd also like to see some immediate common sense actions taken that anybody any manager, any leader will tell you that if you work somebody over 100 hours a week, you're not going to get an efficient output. And there's many other aspects that are doing. If you keep deploying ships more than 7 months a year, you're not going to keep good people in the Navy. You're just not. They prefer a better life. And so,
well, how the fuck do we do what we're supposed to do, given our commitments, when you keep shrinking the number of fucking ships, Senator?
And finally, speak truth to power. One of the reasons why you are having to impose these burdens and the extended deployments and the lack of readiness is because of sequestration. When you don't know when you don't know in September what you're going to be doing in October, that's not right and it's not fair. So, and Admiral Richardson, I'd like to thank you for your very frank and candid comments on that issue before this committee. So I'd just like to finally say there are additional families.
All right, he makes some additional remarks to family. But again, but I will go back to this. My experience deploying to Iraq and Afghanistan, and when you're operating, and even my time when I was on sea duty, you know, my schedule wasn't much different. Get up at 5, into work at 6, read message traffic, check your email to see, you know, who was looking for what. Supervise the training during the course of the day, do any performance counseling during the evening, whatever meetings you had to go to during the day. But you were at sea. What else were you going to do? And so this, again, this notion, here's the problem that I see. And it goes back to discipline and leadership. And I would, they're not the same things. And I'll be real quick. Discipline. I say it and you do it. That's discipline. And when you're in the military, when you tell people they need to go, you know, they need to take care of themselves, they better do it. All right. Now here's the leadership piece. Okay. The supervision of that. When it comes to your attention that that isn't going on, you need to take corrective action so that A, they go get their sleep and somebody supervises it. I'm going to come down and I'm going to check. And then if they can't do that, then you push them out of those key billets. But think about this. If you heard the description of the watch bridge, all right? You know, according to Admiral Richardson, that's 10 people. Okay? That's backed up by the Combat Information Center. And I believe a guy called the TAO is down there. And they're looking at radars as well. Redundant capacity on the bridge. You have people on the bridge with binoculars looking. And then there's supposedly people external to the ship that are looking as well. All of that fails to the point. And again, my experience of bad things happening, that wasn't the first time it happened. And I had somebody send me an email yesterday. Might it be because every one of these instances is relatively close to the coast, and might they still have cell phone reception? Forwarded to me by a surface warfare officer that has served in the region. Is that what we're going to find? That they were on their cell phones? Anyway, we'll take a break. Interesting stuff. I will post the link to the entire hearing as I post this thing to the webpage. So when you see this entry, go ahead and you'll see the link that is in. It says SASC hearing on recent collisions at sea. If you click on that link, it will take you to the entire 2.5 hour hearing. It starts about 23 minutes into the tape. You'll click on it and nothing plays. I don't know why they have dead air for 20 something minutes, but they do. So if you're interested in watching the whole thing, and I would recommend it. Just interesting stuff. Interesting stuff. I think the frustrating thing is, the Navy knows what happened. The Navy knows what happened in all these incidents. Okay? It was all there on the bridge. Within 24 hours, you knew what happened. So why we're playing games, I'm not exactly sure. You can go do the Warren report later. Tell me what the fuck happened. There's not even a report out on the USS Lake Champlain. Running into a fishing vessel. So, anyway. All right, we're going to switch gears. Phil Smith's going to join us. He's a smart guy, and we'll talk to him. So, more of All Marine Radio on a Wednesday, hump day. Jake LaMotta passed away, in case you don't know that. I didn't know he was still alive. Jake LaMotta, 95 years old. The Raging Bull. dies at the age of 95. More of a All Marine Radio coming up next.